This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
G'day, thanks for downloading the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Now, the royal couple, Prince William and Kate, have been touring Australia this week, visiting Uluru. We talk with NITV's news presenter, Natalie Armat, about what the visit meant to the traditional owners, the Anangu people of the Northern Territory. Political activist Melinda Tankard-Reist reflects on the life of Senator Brian Harradine after attending his state funeral. Melinda worked for Brian during his parliamentary career, and she's drawn a lot of inspiration from his passionate commitment to social justice. Colette Smart talks about the friends with benefits concept. More young people seem to be embracing the idea of casual relationships, but are they selling themselves short if they're giving away physical intimacy without any thought of commitment? And for Anzac Day, we explore the lives of two inspiring people who died at the hands of the Nazi regime during World War II, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and Anne Frank. There's a new play, Lies, Love and Hitler, about the life and work of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. That's showing at the old Fitzroy Theatre in Woolloomooloo. We talked to the play's writer, Elizabeth Avery Scott, about why she finds the German theologian and Nazi resistor so inspiring. And the exhibition Anne Frank, A History for Today, is showing at the Sydney Jewish Museum. We talked to Boyd Clapp about growing up in Nazi-controlled Europe and why he's so dedicated to sharing the Anne Frank story. Finally, Mark Hadley reviews the new Johnny Depp film Transcendence. Is it just for geeks? We'll find out. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Senator Brian Harradine was farewelled with a state funeral in Hobart yesterday. He was Australia's longest serving independent senator before he died at the age of 79. Brian was known publicly as a devout Christian, and he was certainly regarded as a man of very strong principles. Melinda Tankard-Reist was his press secretary, and she joins me now to reflect on the man that she knew. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Katrina.
Yeah, yesterday must have been a really sad day for you.
Look, it really was. It was a day of sadness and reflection on the man that we all knew and had the pleasure to serve, and also, of course, to share in the grief with the family. Mm. There were many parliamentary colleagues there, also John Howard, the former Prime Minister. You know, Brian crossed a lot of the usual sort of political divides and brought a lot of people together yesterday. I lost it at a Bide with me, and it sort of went downhill from there.
Oh.
Profoundly moving.
Yeah. What did you appreciate about Senator Brian Harradine when you worked with him?
Well, I found myself reflecting more on Brian, the man that I knew, rather than the politician. What I appreciated, I suppose, most as a mum with young children was flexibility. Brian was actually pretty progressive in that regard. There was no childcare at Parliament House, and I had young children. I was able to continue to breastfeed, to have flexibility, to come and go as I needed to. You know, he was a strong family man and ensured that I could enjoy the best of both worlds. I often had a baby in the office with me. I often had bottles of my Express breast milk in the fridge with his beer. The cot was set up in his office. He'd take the baby for a walk at lunchtime. You know, he welcomed children. My children were always welcome in that place. I mean, they saw it as just a giant theme park, really. They referred to Parliament House as Mummy's office and loved coming up there and, you know, playing with the security buttons and rolling down the lawns outside Parliament House from the roof in the days before 9/11 when you're able to do that. I appreciated his care for me, his care for my family, and also the incredible opportunities he gave me to pursue the issues that we both cared about. He enabled me really to pursue those issues and sort of reach my potential, I think.
Yeah, what were the issues that he was most passionate about, Melinda?
Well, the issues that I mostly worked with him on were human rights issues, social justice issues, refugees, asylum seekers, of course, pro-life issues, the dignity of the human individual. He had a very strong sense of social justice teachings, particularly Catholic social justice teachings, and he was all about the common good.
Even though some of those issues you mentioned might be very divisive, he was very successful in retaining his seat for such a long time as an independent. Why do you think people kept voting for him?
Well, something I found fascinating was how many people would write to us or ring us up and say, look, I don't necessarily agree with Brian on all his positions, but I want him there. I want him in the parliament. You know, Brian was a strong conviction politician. He couldn't be bought. He was an independent. He had the luxury of not having to bow to party discipline. He would never be told what to do by anybody, and he was his own man. And I think he is a brilliant example of someone in high public office who can retain their convictions, their integrity, their decency, and achieve the best they could, particularly for the state of Tasmania.
I can only imagine, though, Melinda, as an independent and as someone with very strong views, that could be also maybe a lonely place to be. You know, he didn't have the support of a party. Just recently, even Mike Baird was reflecting on how lonely politics can be. Do you think that was true for Senator Harradine?
It's definitely true for Brian, given that he was in for 30 years and given his love for his family, his passionate love for his wife, Marion. It was lonely for him to be separated. You know, he had 13 children, and Marion brought seven into the marriage and Brian brought six into the marriage. Both had lost their partners to cancer. You know, I think if he hadn't had such a strong calling and if he hadn't seen politics as his vocation, he would have been just the happiest being with the family and hiking with Marion in the Tasmanian wilderness. He didn't have a lot of friends, but the friends he had were loyal and devoted. Stuck by him through thick and thin, but there's no doubt about it, this is a lonely life.
As you reflect back on your time working for him, Melinda, what lasting influence has he had on your life and your career since then?
The impact he's had is on holding a line, taking a stand, paying a price for taking a stand. I realised that being with Brian was actually a training ground for what was to come for me personally, and some of the vilification and hate and death threats, and I think I saw how Brian dealt with that and retained and stayed strong through it. And that stayed with me. And he also taught me how to do politics. Look, he's taught me so many things. And I, you know, every Christmas I'd write to him and say, you know, I just want you to know that, you know, you have had this lasting impact. And thank you, thank you for all you taught me. And hopefully, you know, your legacy will continue through the people that you've influenced.
Thank you so much, Melinda, for sharing some of your experiences with us. It sounds like that was really formative time in your life, working with him.
It certainly was.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. That's Melinda Tankard-Reese reflecting on the life of Senator Brian Harradine. Prince William and Kate spent a very full day in the Red Centre yesterday, where they spent some time with the traditional owners of Uluru, being introduced to the ancient Anangu culture. Natalie Armat is NITV's news presenter, and she's been following the royal visit from the perspective of the Northern Territory's local Indigenous people. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. What's the weather been like up there for the royal visit, Natalie?
Oh, it has been perfect. In fact, I've been lucky enough to be here 9 days, and I think I saw one cloud in all that time.
So wow.
It was absolutely stunning, and, yeah, what a backdrop for that royal visit.
Absolutely.
Yesterday. Although I did hear William apparently commented it was a little bit hot for his taste, so probably lucky he came this time of year and not kind of in the November or December where it gets up in the 40s.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. The Duke and Duchess of Cambridge received a very warm welcome from the Anangu people. And from the locals you've spoken to, how did they feel about the royal visit, Natalie?
They were just delighted. I mean, the Anangu are such a lovely people, and this area is so rich in culture, and they're very keen to share that with all visitors, whether they're royalty or not. But they were just delighted at the opportunity, and I guess they saw it as a sign of royal respect that Prince William wanted to come back. Of course, last time he was here, he was 8 months old, so just a little bit older than Prince George now. And I know a lot of the elders were around back then in 1983 when Prince Charles and Diana brought baby William out, and many of them were involved in showing them around in 1983. So now to be meeting Prince Charles's son, all grown up, with his wife. Family is so important to the Anangu culture that they're delighted that they've been able to keep that connection to the royals going over more than 20 years.
Yeah, now I understand that back when Charles and Diana visited, they actually climbed a small part of Uluru, which obviously wouldn't be done now, but I understand that Kate and William took a private walk around the base with the traditional owner yesterday, is that right?
That's correct. Yes, a guy by the name of Sammy Wilson was their guide, and media weren't allowed down at the waterhole at the end of the trail. That was kept as just a private moment for William and Kate. But it's a beautiful, shady, picturesque walk. They would have seen some rock art along the way that I'm sure Sammy would have explained, and I'm sure he would have told them the story of that place as well. It's the Woma Python Woman and the Poisonous Snake Man is sort of the local chukapa, which is, the Anangu's way of passing down their culture through stories and also song and dance, as we saw at the Imma a little earlier yesterday. So I'm sure that would have been a real highlight for Prince William and Kate, and I reckon probably even better given the warm conditions out here than climbing the rock anyway. But obviously,
absolutely,
back in 1983 when they did that, I guess not as much was known about the Anangu's beliefs and wishes not to climb on the rocks.
Yeah.
But I think the experience they got would have been far better anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one thing that I appreciate about the royal couple is that they do use their celebrity to draw attention to positive things that are happening in communities. And one of those territory success stories is the National Indigenous Training Academy. Tell us a little bit about their visit there yesterday.
The academy was established, I think, in 2011 because they sort of noticed that when the Indigenous Land Corporation bought the Ayers Rock Resort and Voyagers took over the running of it on the ILC's behalf, there was actually only two Indigenous people working across all of the resorts, the restaurants, the cafes, which is, considering this area is so rich in Aboriginal culture, struck the ILC as something that needed fixing. So they've established this National Indigenous Training Academy, which brings young people, young Indigenous people from right around the country to the Red Centre to do a one-year very practical hands-on sort of training certificate to ready them for work in the hospitality and tourism industry. Many of them have loved their Red Centre experience so much that they've actually stayed here. So in a very short period of time, largely thanks to the National Indigenous Training Academy, we've seen the numbers grow from just 2 to 230.
Yeah.
When we checked in, we're greeted by one of the young trained, or now a graduate, at the front desk. So, what a great experience for international visitors to receive that greeting, the first person you meet.
Yeah, what a success story. And they must have been very chuffed to get their certificates from the royal couple yesterday.
Yeah, there was one girl that was running around saying, "I'm never washing my hand again." So she was... She was delighted, and I think Prince William and Kate were also very happy to be there. One of the young girls had painted painted some beads and strung it together in a bracelet, and Kate put that on straight away. And then William looked really chuffed when he was presented with a spear, so you could see him really examining that. And yes, I think he was really happy to receive that. And of course, then when he got to the cultural centre, they gave him the shield as well. So, you know, perhaps there'll be an invitation imminent from the Anangu to Prince William to come back and perhaps go hunting and try it out. I don't know.
I can't quite picture it myself, but it would be interesting.
He did look pretty happy with both of those gifts.
I think he would have been. Yeah, well, it sounds like it was a great day, and the Duke and Duchess will be very soon leaving for Adelaide, won't they?
They will. They sort of watched sunset last night. That was the last that we saw of them in the media. Of course, that lovely shot of them enjoying the sunset. Then they were taken off. They were staying in some quite luxurious accommodation. So I'm sure that was lovely for them. Candlelit dinner, well, under the stars here in Central Australia. And yes, just a sort of private morning this morning, no doubt enjoying the sunrise over Uluru before they get on the plane and head to their next stop in Adelaide.
Well, thanks so much for telling us a little bit about the visit, Natalie. Good to talk to you.
A pleasure. Thank you.
That's Natalie Armat. She's the presenter of NITV News with SBS, and she's in the Red Centre for the royal visit there. The concept of friends with benefits became mainstream with the 2011 movie of the same name. And while it's kind of quite a shocking concept, or particularly the way it was portrayed in that film, look, the concept has extended into mainstream society. There are even a number of dating sites by that name that promise casual relationships with no strings attached. But how is this concept of friends with benefits impacting on our teens and our young adults? Adolescent psychologist Colette Smart's on the line. Hi, Colette.
Hi, Katrina.
How would you explain the friends with benefits concept? Like, how is it different to a normal dating relationship?
Well, I think how it's different is you have young people who are friends by day or around their other mates, but then they kind of make out partners, will kiss or become intimate with no clear direction of any relationship or romantic relationship. The relationship's not headed in any kind of romantic direction. Mm. So they're kind of free to call themselves single, yet still have the attachment of a dating relationship on the side. And often it's private, so her friends may not know about it.
That's what I was thinking. It sort of implies there's a bit of secrecy, isn't there? Because they're not an official couple, so they're kind of doing this behind closed doors. It's sort of on the sly thing.
Yeah, and sometimes you will have young people who will joke about it or say, "Oh, yeah, he's a friend or she's a friend with benefits." So it's not kind of taken as a serious romantic relationship.
Mm. What's the problems with this kind of style of relationship, Colette?
We're living in this age where we're kind of afraid to call things right and wrong. I believe, and we're almost afraid to say things are black and white. And I think the problem is this hindering of true friendships. So straddling the fence with friends with this benefits relationship destroys your ability to actually experience true intimacy within a friendship context, but also robs young people of the joy of engaging in a healthy romantic relationship. So it's very confusing. You lose the ability to have very good friends and have romance at the same time in a separate relationship.
It seems like, you know, girls who have these kind of relationships might be lacking a sense of their own worth. Like they're almost giving away that intimacy without any kind of return commitment.
Yeah, I think I always say friends with benefits, but benefits for whom? Because without a strong and trusting relationship based on any long-term commitment, how do you know that someone is taking from you or something that you're giving to someone else is not inherently selfish? Because the reason I say that is because intimacy of any kind is a gift. You know, young people will experience holding hands and all sorts of things, but when something is based on my wants and my needs and my pleasures, which essentially is what friends with benefits is, somebody will always end up getting hurt. No matter how much we think we're engaging in some sort of freedom, we can always be certain of two things. The professor who's a pastor and a philosopher in the States, Dale Keane, says in this age of individualism, when we are individual in intimate relationships, we're only certain of two things. One is you will end up using someone or you will be used by someone for personal gain when you're not actually thinking of giving to others in a relationship.
Yeah, it's really a terrible way to treat people, isn't it?
Yeah.
But look, if someone's in an unhealthy sort of relationship like this, how do you get out of it? Because, you know, you can't just break up. You're not actually officially a couple. And people may not want to lose the friendship, but they may realise that this pattern of relating is unhealthy. What do you do then?
So I think the first thing is to ask yourself four things. So look at your relationship. Say, is this relationship lacking any healthy boundaries? Am I setting limits? Am I then selling my value short and just giving myself and my body and my time without requiring commitment? And then has this physical part of our relationship skewed my rational ability to think through what friendship is? Mm-hmm. And then be honest with yourself. You know, is this setting myself and somebody else up for heartbreak? And if you answer yes to these things, I think it's really important then to bring the relationship out into the light. Go mm-hmm. and get another mate, get a friend and say, look, this is what's happened between me and another friend. And I really value that person's friendship and I want to end this side of it. And I think it's important to have accountability with someone and then bring in those strong boundaries. Say, this is where we draw the line because essentially that relationship hasn't had boundaries. Mm. So take ownership of your choices. Don't blur the lines in your relationship and embrace your God-given self, you know, that you're given value by God because shades of grey are always disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thanks, Colette. It's a bit of an icky one to talk about, but it's certainly one we need to talk about. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's Colette Smart from Family Smart talking about this concept of friends with benefits, a sort of casual style of relationship. You can find out more about Colette at familysmart.com.au. Lies, Love and Hitler is a play about a 39-year-old professor who finds himself in a personal moral dilemma after he falls for one of his students. But it's also the story of Nazi resistor and theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was part of a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler. Love, Lies and Hitler was written by Elizabeth Avery Scott, and she joins me on the phone now to have a chat about it. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Katrina. How are you?
Yeah, good. Congratulations on a great show. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, the main character in your play, Professor Langley, he has this long-standing admiration for and really fascination with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Does that reflect your own interest in the man, Elizabeth?
Well, I guess, yes, it does. I heard about Dietrich Bonhoeffer many years ago now in a church context. I heard a quote from him, mm-hmm. and that really made me think. And being a journalist at the time, I started to sniff out this Dietrich Bonhoeffer and did a bit of reading and followed up from there and found him to be a very fascinating man.
Yeah, okay. What makes Bonhoeffer, you know, a relevant sort of hero for our time, do you think?
Well, it's probably a couple of things. One is that, I guess, in the time that he lived, in the Second World War, it was a very dark time. There were many huge moral struggles and dilemmas that occurred. And he, as a clergyman or theologian in that context, was kind of different. You know, he ended up being a double agent and working to bring down Hitler. And so I suppose there's this kind of adventurous story that revolves around him as a character in history. Another thing which I think is particularly interesting and makes him relevant for today is that he left behind many writings, not just letters and papers from when he was in prison, letters to his fiancée, but also many other writings, some philosophical and theological writings, which continue to have an impact on people around the world today.
Yeah, people are probably familiar with him as a theologian and with some of his works. I guess what was interesting for me was seeing the more romantic side of Bonhoeffer, which came through in some of the letters. What I found interesting is the way that the play sort of juxtaposes what seems like a more minor moral dilemma, I suppose, a professor who finds himself in a complicated romantic relationship with a student, against Bonhoeffer's sort of very noble stand against the Nazi regime. What was the idea behind that?
Yeah, I guess what I wanted to do was to provoke some questions. I wanted to ask the question, well, you know, if I were in that situation that Bonhoeffer was in, what kind of action would I take and what would be my point of origin for starting that thinking process to work out where I would end up? And then also to go, well, in our modern setting, particularly in Australia, less so in other parts of the world which are more troubled, but particularly in Australia, we're very focused on our individual and personal problems and mm-hmm. they kind of become our whole world in a sense, whereas in other parts of the world people are kind of suffering and living under more difficult situations. So I guess I wanted to juxtapose those two things and really provoke some questions about how we make decisions and also look at whether can we really compare our little tiny problems to some of the really bigger problems that are in the world, or is that really not on? Can we ever compare anything that we do personally to the great massive issues around the Holocaust and other things which other people are facing in our contemporary setting? Mm. So I guess that was some of the questions I wanted to provoke, and I hope people come away from the play thinking along those lines anyway.
Yeah, it was certainly interesting even just to see characters agonising over something from a moral perspective, because it's not something that you see in much, you know, modern TV or film.
Yes, I guess that's probably right. And I think, you know, people who come from a framework of Christian belief or even other sets of beliefs possibly struggle a little bit more as they try and work out, you know, where they stand on things, because they're trying to work out where they fit in and whether those ideas actually work in a practical setting. But yes, I think some of the most interesting drama and the most interesting theatre and the most interesting films do come out of this position of looking at ethical dilemmas.
And it certainly comes from a place of anguish, I suppose, which makes for drama. And what do you hope that audiences are going to take away from this play, Elizabeth?
Yeah, well, I hope they have a few laughs. I hope they have a few interesting conversations. There's a lot of ideas in the play, but it's also a story, and I hope that they appreciate the story, or in fact the two stories that are running in parallel in the play. And I think we have a lot to learn from stories, and I hope that people enjoy the characters and how they find their way through that story as well.
Very interesting characters and some very touching moments in the play. So, yeah, thank you, Elizabeth, for taking time to have a chat about it today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, that's Lies, Love and Hitler writer Elizabeth Avery Scott. The play is on at the old Fitzroy Theatre in Woolloomooloo until May 3rd, and you can find it online at liesloveandhitler.com. On the 12th of June, 1942, a young girl called Anne was given a diary for her 13th birthday. Little did she know that this diary would go on to become one of the world's top 10 most read books. The diary of Anne Frank captures so much of the horror of the Holocaust and the fear that Jewish people lived with at that time, as seen through the eyes of a young teenage girl. Well, now you can experience Anne's story through the exhibition Anne Frank, A History for Today, which is showing at the Sydney Jewish Museum until June 8th. Boyd Clapp is the chairman of the Anne Frank Travelling Exhibition. Welcome, Boyd.
Thank you, Katrina.
Now, how did you come to be involved with the Anne Frank Travelling Exhibition?
Well, currently I'm living in Wellington, New Zealand, and I was fairly close to the Jewish community. I'm not a Jew myself, but I experienced the Second World War. I did see what happened to the Jews, like neighbours who were taken to concentration camps and never came back, young boy. So I had a complete commitment to the Anne Frank story and to the Holocaust. You see, the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam, and many people have been there, 1.3 million people go through it each year. It is incredible. There's a big queue. It takes up to 2 hours to get in. But it was felt that there needed to be an exhibition that could be taken around the world so that the story of Anne Frank, the story of the Holocaust, the story of discrimination would also be known to people who don't visit Amsterdam. Mm. And as a result of that, it's been in 80 countries and 10 million people have seen the exhibition.
The Diary of Anne Frank, it's a book that has endured. Why does it still resonate with readers today?
Well, in the first place, she was a very good writer. I mean, the fact that people like to read it is because it is well written. Mm. Secondly, this was a young woman who was absolutely much older in her thoughts than other people at her age. She writes with extreme clarity. But the Holocaust and the 1.5 million children that were killed, it's personified by Anne more or less represents the 1.5 million children that were killed. Because to me, it's just unbelievable it happened. It did. Some people say it is not 1.5 million people who were killed. One child was killed 1.5 million times. And I think we can relate to that through Anne Frank. She was the one that was there. She was just one of all those. But she was the one that was able to put into words her thoughts.
And it is so much more devastating that she didn't survive because you really get to know her through her book, don't you? And so you feel the loss of that life and all that potential.
I heard two Holocaust survivors speaking. And at that function, somebody said, if you walk through the Anne Frank house, you actually meet Anne Frank. She's still there. Mm. And if you look at the visitor's book, many, many young people write to Anne, "Dear Anne, you are my inspiration." Or, "Dear Anne, I'm a 17-year-old girl. I think I've got a problem and I haven't done my homework. I'm ashamed. You inspire me. I admire you. And I now realize how lucky I am."
I mean, I certainly felt that connection when I went to the Anne Frank house and seeing that bookcase that she and her family hid behind. It's such a real and tangible connection to those events that happened 75 years ago. How does this exhibition create that sort of sense of taking you back to that place and time?
Yeah, the exhibition consists of 11 panels, and the panels have a timeline. So there's a timeline of the history starting in 1918 with the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War. So step by step, you see what happened in Germany, the Kristallnacht, the Night of the Broken Glasses, Hitler's become Chancellor, the war, and it finishes in Auschwitz. But then you have the story of Anne Frank, and it is on that same timeline below, so you can relate, you can see where they were and what happened. Now, it's very hard for me to explain why it is such an emotional exhibition, because panels, but I can tell you, and I've now been involved 5 years, I've seen it in 20 museums. I walk in from time to time after the opening. You can hear a pin drop. People experience the whole story again. And we know the end of the story. But there's many a tear at the end of it. It is quite incredible. Lots of photos taken by Otto Frank. Mm. He was a very good photographer and lots of writings. But it's been so well done that you experience the story as you walk past. And you probably need a couple of hours.
Mm. What do you hope people will learn from this?
Oh, I hope that people learn what happens when you discriminate, that discrimination starts with feeling superior over another person. It really is discrimination, and that step by step, anti-Semitism can lead to government controls and to extermination. We can learn from that that it happens today. It happened in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge. It's happening in Syria probably today. We must learn not to discriminate. Mm. We must learn not to feel superior over other people. If not, history will repeat itself.
Mm. And as someone, you're a young boy when this was going on around you.
Yeah.
How vivid are your memories from that time? And how strong is I guess, the feeling that's brought up by that?
Well, between 13 and 18, very formative years, and of course you can remember a lot of that. I remember the day the Germans invaded. I remember the day that our Jewish neighbors were reported and never came back. We had 26 air raids in the city, not far from our home. The roof was blown off. The war is very clear. I don't live in the past. I live for the future, and that's why I'm involved in the Anne Frank exhibition. But the fact that you couldn't speak freely, the fact that you couldn't trust people, the fact that people were arrested, that sometimes when something happened that the Nazis didn't like, say one of their officers was shot, ambushed, they would take 10 prominent people. Just imagine that. The mayor of Sydney, the mayor of Dubbo, whatever, a prominent lawyer, and they would take those 10, shoot them, and put them on a central place of the city. You can't imagine that, can you, really?
No, you can't imagine. I mean, my father grew up with it, as you did, living in that time. But for those of us who have grown up all our lives in Australia, we can't even really imagine what it's like.
No. But we need to be aware of it. Mm. We need to be aware of this world because it's happening in different parts of the world. And I think that one of the things that I feel strongly about, there are very few Holocaust survivors left. They tell the story, like one man I met last week. He read out names and the date of birth, his grandfather, his grandmother, his mother, his father, his two sisters, his cousins. It was a whole long list. And why did he read it out? Because they were all killed and he was the only one left. But those Holocaust survivors, when they've died, we must continue to make certain that people know the story so that history doesn't repeat itself.
Mm, absolutely. The amazing thing that what the Anne Frank House shows is that it starts with a tiny seed of racism.
Yes.
And I think you've brought that home very well today as well, too.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Katrina.
That's Boyd Clapp. He is the chairman of the Anne Frank Travelling Exhibition. You can see Anne Frank, A History for Today, at the Sydney Jewish Museum. It's showing until June 8th. And you can find out more at sydneyjewishmuseum.com.au. Transcendence is a film about the world's leading artificial intelligence expert who, when faced with his imminent death, uploads his mind into a computer and lives on as a form of artificial intelligence. It's the directing debut of Wally Pfister, the cinematographer who filmed Inception, and it opens in cinemas today. Mark Hadley, our film reviewer, has been to see it. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you going?
Is this one of those sort of complex sci-fis, like Inception, that also explores some big ideas?
Look, it is one of those films where in which there are plenty of big ideas and they've tried to pitch it at a non-sci-fi audience. It's supposed to be for everyone.
Okay.
I was sitting in the cinema and I had an audience of about, 400 people at the preview. And you could, audibly hear people going, it was obvious, it was a mainstream audience. There weren't that many sort of people who were, from the fringes of geekdom.
Yeah.
So it was a mainstream audience and people were really getting progressively confused.
Yeah, now, right.
In the world of geekdom, the concept of singularity has been discussed for, more than a few years now.
Okay, what is that?
Yeah, there you go. So now, singularity is what's supposed to happen when technology and man combine or collide, depending on your perspective, to such a degree that we're no longer inseparable and our brains start making quantum leaps, you know, advances in the ability to think. So think of it in terms of like a computer mind so powerful, it rushes away with itself. It's calculating, you know, tens of thousands of solutions a second, you know, to the point where suddenly it's almost godlike. And so,
Mark, I think you're living on the fringes of geekdom.
I am. I actually keep one foot in geekdom just so I can understand. I speak fluent geek.
Okay, good. So, excellent. You can translate for me.
I will. So basically, this concept has been discussed for a long time for people who are interested in sort of, you know, artificial intelligence and the advancing in computing. Everything from people who think we're using our mobile phones too much to, you know, people who are studying sort of quite complex quantum physics.
Well, I had to ask you, is this another movie that is kind of questioning our relationship with technology? Because there's been a few of those lately.
Yes, I mean, the most recent being Her, of course.
Mm.
Look, those, you know, films are going to keep coming along so long as when I get up in the morning, the first thing I see is my mobile phone or my iPad, you know, before I see the actual people around me.
Okay.
The day that we started carrying around technology to the point where people were more concerned about where their phone was than where their wallet was, you know, is the day that we had to start asking ourselves, had technology got too close? And these films are going to continue to come out. And the idea is, that's why it's supposed to be a sort of a mainstream story. So the idea is, if computers get so powerful that we merge with them, and then you can no longer tell where the person ends and the program begins, then, you know, what have we lost? Have we lost some sort of essential idea of our own humanity? Now, the question is that really realistic?
So you think maybe this film is sort of taking it so far that it becomes irrelevant because you're no longer believing it?
Yeah, I think so. Look, it takes reality and it bends it and twists it into a pretzel shape that we no longer recognize. You know what the big factor is that they leave behind? And they always do this. It's that technology doesn't form in a vacuum. You know, it comes into existence in the context of people. Transcendence doesn't allow enough for the fact that people are not like the people in the film that come about to produce this. You know, what happens in the real world is you don't have these supercomputers come into existence without somebody saying, hey, but how much is this going to cost? Do you know how much power you're draining?
Yeah.
You know, and some person coming in at a micromanager
so it's sort of
saying it's going to paint green or something.
It sounds like you're saying it's like it's unmoderated, but in the real world, people actually do say, hey, let's draw a line here or something.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, I think the very fact that we're talking about it says, you know, people are interested in drawing lines as to if people are interested in what it means to be human. I mean, you'll come across in Transcendence incredible ideas like artificial intelligence, we've mentioned, and nanobots, you know, those sorts of things, machines, you know, almost a biotechnical machine so small that they can be inside blood vessels and things like that. That technology, which I heard some people in the cinema going, oh, like that would happen, is actually really in development. So that's not really the question. The question is, can and will people behave in such a way that they will surrender what it is to be human?
Mm.
And I think the interesting thing about this is that when human beings keep discussing these stories, they always come to the same conclusion, that we are more than just a series of ones and zeros, that we cannot actually be summarized onto some sort of CD or hard drive. Christians, you know, believe that inherently we've got, you know, something more than an electronic or even, you know, Wi-Fi connection with the world outside. We've actually got a deep spiritual connection with the creator of the universe. Because, you know, as a sci-fi nut and as a Christian, I also believe that there is some form of us that extends beyond our bodies. And so the idea of, you know, some people might call it the soul, we might call it our spirit, but in essence, that's not something a computer is going to replicate terribly well.
No, that's true. All right, thanks, Mark. Thanks for drawing it to our attention.
Always happy to.
Yeah, it's our film reviewer, Mark Hadley. We've been talking about Transcendence. It stars Johnny Depp and Morgan Freeman and opens in cinemas today.